Hi there. Who are you?
I'm Zach Smith.
Yeah, we usually do ask people to sign in. Now, we're not going to tell anybody that outside of school we're friends. Oh, we already did that, didn't
okay.
we?
Yep.
So this is an interview to celebrate a very special event this summer.
That would be We Are the 80s?
Yes. There's a special event that... No. Actually, just the fact that you and I are still alive. I think that's a good special event.
I'll toast that.
Did I tell you we're doing an entire hour dedicated to what we're going to do here?
I did not. You did not tell me.
I don't
me
know that. How we're going to fill the hour, but we'll figure it out. This is an interview, by the way. Have you noticed?
It's starting.
This is it.
It's dawning on me.
Okay. Here we go. Ready?
Let's go.
So, Zach Smith, this is your life. Are you ready? Here we go.
Uh-oh.
Now, Scandal was formed. Oh, yes. We will talk about that. We're not going to do this the formal way. We'll eventually let people know who the hell you are. I'm going to launch into the interview, and maybe about 15 minutes in.
I feel panic setting in.
People will actually know. Well, between your shirt and my shirt, thank God this is radio. Now, is that on? We should know this, you and I. Would your shirt pixelate this way, to the left and the right, or up and down?
My shirt would drive any camera completely mad.
Good. Well planned, because it's radio. New York. Scandal was formed in New York, but you are Westport, Connecticut?
That's right.
Wow.
The country club background.
Grew up in the lap of rock and roll luxury.
That's right.
Yeah, Westport, actually a lot of friends were from Westport. And, you know, so there's two East Coast boys in the room, which means that the hour is going to go very, very fast.
The thing about Westport was that Dick Sandhouse was from Westport. He was a year ahead of me in school. He already had the instinct to be a promoter, and he was able to bring Sly and the Family Stone, The Doors, Cream.
All to Connecticut.
All to my high school, which had a 2,200-seat auditorium.
Okay, I'm pissed right now. We had Jay and the Americans in Spring Valley, New York. That's
nice.
Who I got. Jay and the Americans. You're getting Sly and the Family Stone.
We were the first Cream date in the U.S. Before they did our high school as a warm-up date to New York.
Okay, this interview is over. I'm sorry. I got Pete Seeger and Jay and the Americans. You're getting Cream and Sly and the Family. I guess Westport, Connecticut had more bucks.
I'm not sure what it was, but you know, the band that played the high school gym on Friday night was called The Strangers, and that was fronted by Steven Tyler.
I'm just laughing. It's kind of like, ladies and gentlemen, Westport High School and Ron Delsner present...
It was a very serious music town.
Oh, my God. But now, let's just get to some of the dirt. That infamous Patti Smyth woman. My research says that you called her up at... The rumor is you called her up at the steakhouse she was working at?
Correct.
How did you hear her sing?
You know, I had been... Paul Schaefer and I had put this band together, like a party band, and I eventually... The Paul Schaefer, right. He was... Saturday Night Live had ended. Letterman hadn't started yet.
So my twin.
That's right, your clone.
Yes.
And so he had a year or two of downtime, and the one thing Paul had never done in his life that he wanted to do was be in a rock band. So we just had this party band, me, Frankie LaRocca, Rick Derringer, Hiram Bullock, all these, you know, kind of floating subs. And eventually Paul said, you know, these songs that you're writing that we're putting in the set list, you know, you should be more serious about them. You should, you know, find a singer and, you know, let's do this right. So I put an ad in the Village Voice and I had a parade of women. But, you know, and I saw lots of people, I mean, some of whom have gone on to be really famous, but I didn't find anyone I liked. And then I was at Catch a Rising Star and Lawrence Juber, a friend of mine who was playing with Wings at the time, said, you know, there's a woman who sings here who does cabaret, and she's great, and she works across the street at Hannibal Steakhouse.
Of course.
Why don't you
where
try
all great singers work. Ladies and gentlemen, Linda Ronstadt, Smith & Walensky's.
There you go. So, you know, I just called up, and the phone there is a payphone, and she answered it.
And she said, I am the warrior.
And, you know, we started fighting right there, and, you know, just kept...
Well, yeah, we'll get there. That's why you named the band. We could get to what the name of the band was, but I think the band just became a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Exactly.
Okay, let me circle back, just because we don't do these interviews in order. Mm-hmm. Your musical training thereof, because I know you today, and I know, you know, your musical acumen, he said, to use at least a $4 word. So what did you go to school for, and how did you learn music and all that stuff? And then we'll come right back to that story, exactly where we left it.
My brother was given a guitar by my parents. I was sort of pointed at piano, and he was going to be able to play guitar. And, you know, I didn't like the piano, and he eventually, you know, did not learn to play the guitar. So I got it, and I learned to play it. And, you know,
So you didn't really go to Juilliard or any of that lovely...
No. No, it's just all ear training. I learned on Kinks records, you know, by just like wearing out the grooves of like the early Stones and Kinks records, British Invasion stuff. And then I just started getting in bands. Like from seventh grade, I was like the lead guitar player in bands. And that's kind of like what I did. Didn't go to school, cut classes. But I'd be in bands with guys that had music training and they'd be like, oh, you can't do that. You know, there's so many rules.
That's why, well, you and I should wear that same T-shirt. You can't do that. And then on the back it says, yes, you can.
Nice one.
Yeah, very, very simple. Okay, circle back. So the woman in the steakhouse, did you just heard she was a good singer?
Yeah, Lawrence said she's really something. She's not doing the style of music you're after here, but she probably could.
So was she more of a chanteuse?
She was more of like, you know, the early Ellie Greenwich school.
Really?
She was singing show tunes and, you know, Judy Garland tunes and, you know, accompanied by a pianist there. And
so you turned her into a rock and roll singer.
I totally did, yeah.
Now, did she have the look at the steakhouse at that moment in time?
All I can say is she was just drop-dead cute.
Right.
She was really cute.
And she was serving up steaks.
She was serving up steaks.
And there were a lot of men coming into that steakhouse and business was good.
That's right.
Sometimes,
but she was, you know, the recalcitrant kid, you know, even then, and a lot of attitude, and just, you know.
So she was made for rock and roll, not for steak.
A real street kid, a Brooklyn street rat, you know.
Right, the real deal. So you had these songs. Did you have a concept for this band?
I did. I mean, girl groups were already starting to be really sort of popular, you know, and I had been in a band in Colorado called Zephyr with Candy Givens, and she had a huge impact on me. And I felt like if I'm going to do a band, I'm going to do it with a girl. And so, yeah, to that extent, I originally thought it would be bluesier, but Paul had a real formative influence in that respect. I mean, he really made everything.
Paul is such a pop guy.
He really loves,
you know, even to this day, you watch him on Letterman and you can see the people that he likes playing with and then those that he's just doing the work.
Yeah,
so to speak. And we won't refer, because I have both on this radio show, so we won't really talk about which or which, but we know which or which.
Yep. Well, Paul and the people that he brought into the project, especially the guys from the Elton John band, really just had just a... I mean...
Now, that was Dee Murray and...
Davey Johnstone.
Right, and Davey Johnstone. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of a cool thing. And then how did you form the rest? So you had Patty, you had yourself. Then how did you decide on the rest of the concept? And what was the concept other than, you know, chick, you know, lead singer?
The concept was really built around the songs. Paul and I and Frankie LaRocca went into the studio and we cut these tracks. We had the tracks really pretty developed before Patty came into the picture. And
so Goodbye to You and Line, and those were already kind of formulated.
Pretty much. And then she came in with her mom one night to this 8-track studio in downtown New York and sang on these tracks. And, I mean, we were all just speechless because it was so...
She was that good.
It was so good. It put the total, like, imprimatur on these tracks.
Wow. So let's talk a little bit about that. So now this EP, did you record that before there was a deal with Columbia?
We... this first group of songs... The ones that you just mentioned included were recorded by me and Paul and then by a couple of producers brought to us by CBS to sort of see what it would be like to sign this band. And then they were ultimately produced again, you know, for the record.
Is this a good time to play a track?
Well, we could play the Goodbye to You demo with the Elton John, Paul Schaefer.
Wow. So what track is that? Just out of curiosity.
That is track 4.
I guess I never could stand to lose. It's such a pity to say goodbye.
That must be an authentic demo, because towards the end I heard some of the dropouts.
Oh, yeah. I've been sort of archiving old stuff. I mean, things that I was on the verge of throwing away. And actually now I'm glad I sort of spent a little time getting it off there.
Yeah, no, it's definitely tricky stuff. Okay, where do we leave the story? We're going to try to go in chronological order. So
I think we were at the 8-Track studio.
You were at the 8-Track studio, and CBS, you were trying to see what CBS was going to do with all of these. Now, just to skip ahead, because I want to tease people. The EP was the, and it's 5 feet from me, that EP was, to this day, am I correct, the best-selling EP in the history of Columbia Records?
I think that's right. It certainly was at the time, and for the, you know, for the years that Scandal was together, I mean, it sold a lot of units.
And the choice of an EP, which is really, you know, EP was a very 50s, 60s concept. Elvis put out those four track, you know, RCA was really smart. They'd put out Hound Dog, and then they'd say, well, he doesn't have the album ready yet, so let's grab the three tracks we've got and let's make a 45 that's got four tracks on it.
Right.
You know, and then they put that cool heavy cardboard cover and everybody said, ooh, we're getting an album. But they weren't getting an album. They were getting the tracks that were ready.
A lot of people don't know that's really the genesis of the
Yeah, so the concept of the EP, what made you decide to introduce the band with that EP?
You know, it wasn't a decision that we made. It was made kind of for us unilaterally.
Oh, come on, the record company, I just can't imagine.
You know,
record companies making decisions?
You know, you find out so fast that it's really it's divide and conquer,
you know, by the
label.
Yes.
And the first divide and conquer was on the producer choice. They picked somebody, you know, that I thought wasn't totally appropriate.
Right.
But they were able to sell it to Patty because he had a Philly kind of R&B background, which is closest to her sort of core musical interest. And he proceeded to make a record that was kind of half good and half bad.
So what would you have done? You know, I've asked this question of people and we have more discussions in the studio about the role of the producer. And of course, you, Zach, play the role of the producer. You know, we'll talk about a project, you know, that you've worked on recently. And there's several of them, obviously. So the role of the producer in the case of this, where it was a new band and you say half good, half bad. Tell me the half good and half bad. Was this, you know, reverb level, you know, Fisher versus Spring versus, or was it a little deeper than that, him not really getting the band?
Well, I think it was the atmosphere of the record. There, songs like Goodbye to You, which already had like a real kind of drive behind them that had come about from Paul's parts and my parts, and it was difficult to sort of change the course of a song like that. But there were lots of others that were more swing songs where it could be, you know, sappy, or it could
Well,
I mean, it's just, I don't think that a lot of the choices that were made on arranging and pre-production some of these songs were ideal.
Wow.
And I would have chosen somebody much more radical for the time. Like, I wanted Mike Thorn to produce that record. And
that would have been a different record.
That's right.
But then again, you can say that about just about every record. Could you imagine if you know the before and after, right? Instead of Weight Loss, it's the before, you know, the producer, and the after the producer. And if you heard more of that, the learning you'd have about the meaning of rock and roll would be pretty...
Well, I've had some really interesting producer experiences, and I can say that there's nothing even close to the impact that a producer will have on the direction, you know, an artist's record goes in, and it's remarkable.
Yeah, I know in film, everybody thinks it's the director, but it's the same thing. It's the producer. The producers own the party.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's so many gifted, really just gifted, genius producers out there, and I think, and I always wanted to hire them. You know, and in fact, in the second record, I got somebody that I felt was like had much more to offer, even though there was a degree of slickness there that I might not have wished for. But still, it was inspiring to work on the second record versus the first one, which was, you know, sort of painful.
Now, Goodbye to You came out in a really interesting moment because my audience knows this well. I was busy DJing and dancing at a club called Spit in Boston. And then right next to it was the Metro. And Metro was the big, giant disco, Studio 54 club. Mm-hmm. And Spit was, you know, the East Village punk dance club where you heard the Police. But then what was happening in, let's pick a number, what was it, 81? In 81, there was Our Lips Are, well, it was 80, but, you know, Our Lips Are Sealed, We've Got the Beat by the Go-Go's. So there was the power pop dance thing going on. But then over here, there was the beginnings of, you know, punk and ska and the English Beat and all of that. Mm-hmm. And here's Goodbye to You, which was power poppy, dancey, but had a rock aesthetic.
Mm-hmm.
So tell me a little bit about that. You know, when somebody said back then, well, what kind of band is Scandal? In amongst everything, you know, are you a new wave band? Because there were all these labels coming out. You were a ska band. You were a punk band. You were a, you know.
I think some bands are what they are because somebody had a vision that that's what it was. And some bands are what they are because there's a confluence of these forces that make it up. Patty, myself, Columbia, the A&R guy we had at the time who had been in the Zombies and, you know, had a vision. The producer that came to the record. And, you know, I probably would have steered it more into, let's say, Till Tuesday, Psychedelic Furs area. But, I mean, I was somewhat thwarted by all these other elements. And so it sort of became an amalgam, you know, a committee decision to by default, just make Scandal whatever came out in the record. You know, there was another thing happening at that time. Pat Benatar, you know, had records out, and you'd go talk to program directors, and they'd be like, well, you know, we added our female rock record this week. You know, it's Pat Benatar. And they had these, like, quota systems.
Genre, yeah.
Yeah, it's like that genre is, you know, filled in. And in the top markets, we were getting that message just, you know, unilaterally. And the record company made a very smart decision to get out of the major markets and go into the secondary and tertiary markets with indie promotion and to build up a groundswell of, like, you know, the count of people playing this thing. And at the same time, of course, MTV had just started, and they got us into MTV, and Patty and I went and did a lot of, you know, spade work with the MTV VJs, you know, really kind of got to know them, and they started banging Goodbye to You.
And speaking of VJs and video, the other thing that my research tells me, it's again a rumor, Love's Got a Line on You, the video cost how much to make?
$50 or something.
It says 20 on the internet, so you've just doubled the value of that. If anybody has a copy of it on eBay, right?
There you go.
And of course, also there was a young man on there that we all came to know pretty well.
John Bon Jovi.
Yeah, him. What did he do on that video?
John was the studio assistant at his uncle's studio, the Power Station, in New York. And Tony Bon Jovi, huge engineer at the time, really talented guy, and you know. John would hang around the studio, and just we got to be friends because our drummer Frank LaRocca and John were really close. And when it came to making the video, all those Elton John guys had sort of like, well, actually D was in it, but Davey was busy, and you know somebody else was busy. And so Frankie said, "Hey, Johnny, come over here, grab this guitar. You're in the video." You know, so.
and so there you go. Was that his first?
Oh, totally.
Rock and roll appearance, so to speak?
Absolutely. Yeah, he hadn't even cut the first, you know, demo with his uncle at the power station.
He didn't even know he was going to give Love a bad name.
But what a sweet kid. Such a sweet kid.
And to this day, he really has a pretty seamless little reputation, doesn't he? He's kind of made it through alive.
He has, and he hasn't stepped over too many bodies. I mean, I there's a soft spot in my heart for Johnny. I mean, we really hung out a lot in those days, you know, just like knocking around the music building, and I thought he was totally sweet.
It's not easy to do.
And then we got them, you know, opening spots for Scandal on the Jersey Shore all the time, and that's how they first sort of began getting booking in the clubs.
The Stone Pony and all of those lovely
that's right.
Lovely places. Should we play another track?
Anything you want.
Well, you tell me. What have you got?
Well, let's see. Why don't we go to track 3, my personal favorite.
And we're going to listen to?
Beat of a Heart.
There you go. Sometimes a fool gets lucky. I've heard that song before.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's got a beat and you can dance to it.
It's really the most used song for, you know, TV and, you know, radio, like, you know.
Oh, let's go
licensing
there.
Stuff.
Well, you know what? We'll stick to the story for one more minute and then we'll go there because that's a fun place to head for, especially these days when, and you know, what you and I do for a living when we're not here. And my audience knows what I do for a living when we're not here. They don't know that much about you, but we'll go there for a couple of minutes if you want to, or we'll just ignore it. But the interesting thing is, you know, every car commercial now, right? All it is cut to the beat to an existing track, mm-hmm. preferably the latest and greatest and something that is, you know, isn't even on radio yet. So it can be,
right.
can be viral. But back to where we were. Okay. So the EP you toured and here we go. Zach was saying before we did this interview, where'd you find this? I'll take off my glasses so I can read it because I'm old and, you know, you can only use your glasses for one thing. This would be from the New York Times, Stephen Holden, July 13th, 1983.
Yikes.
Rock, Scandal plays the Ritz. Are you ready to
That's a review?
Yes, are you ready to relive this night?
Oh, boy.
You know, it's because we're not, you know, doing the bringing back the band thing here, which we'll get to in a minute, because I think after this it'll be appropriate. We can go into the negative zone. Let's go into the bad zone for a couple of minutes. Zone, the dark side. Rock, Scandal plays the Ritz. With the age of video rock upon us, a young band's chances for commercial success depend on as much on as presenting a slick visual package as its musical merit. See, that's his intro. That's his little, here we go. Scandal, an up-and-coming New York-based band heavily promoted by MTA. Who was MTA? You worked for the Metropolitan Transit Authority? You had the subway, so you did those
copy editors weren't what, you know, what they are today.
I know. This is a great typo, a usually good-looking group. That's what it says. You know, I wonder if when it was transferred to the net, whether you were a usually good-looking group or an unusually good-looking group. I love typos. Whose 25-year-old singer, Patti Smyth, looks like Linda Ronstadt's kid sister, and but she still looks much better today than Linda does.
Yes.
But we'll leave that alone, because Linda was just here the other night. Kid sister, and has the vocal style of a punkier Pat Benatar. At the Ritz, I love the way the Times writes, where the group gave three performances this weekend, Scandal's visual glamour seemed far more evolved than its music. Arranged for two guitars, keyboard, bass, and drums, that music is formulaic punkish pop of no special distinction. I love it. I got to see the look on Zach's face. He's like, whatever.
I'm buying it.
Yeah, I know. Oh, it's true, right? Among the tunes written by the guitarist Zach Smith, only the MTV hit Goodbye to You has a truly catchy tune. And while Miss Smythe has a strong rock delivery, her loud, bratty stage personality is strictly one-dimensional. Where's Stephen Holden today? He's still writing for the Times, isn't he?
I really respect Stephen Holden. I mean,
yeah.
I really can't take issue with
that. Which shoulder did he have the chip on is the question. did he want a date with Patty and she just at the time said, I'm sorry?
I think that was probably a really accurate interview.
Good. Well, there you go.
Or review. I mean,
because it was early on.
Well, I have to say, you know, I mean, I'm not a Scandal basher, but I mean, that band had its limitations.
Right.
You know, and some of them came from within and some of them from without.
You're saying that Scandal had its limitations, but if I look at the family tree of all the people that Scandal became associated with, there's a lot of rock and roll royalty in there.
Well, you know, I'll make, you know, a bold statement, which is that, you know, if I had unilateral power to direct Scandal, which I did in the very beginning but quickly did not when I took on a partner and then had the label sort of like co-opt that, you know, my vision for how these records would be made, for what songs we would use, for the whole thing
would have been a little different.
Would really have been different, and down to choices of producers, choices of bandmates, etc. But you know, a band is a group of people, and very often, you know, there are committee decisions. And unfortunately, in the case of Scandal, they weren't good decisions, in my opinion.
But let's kind of work our way through now. However, they were bad decisions, but they resulted in a platinum record.
Right.
So, is it a bad decision based on the fact that you would have rather, and I ask people this all the time, have sold less records and made better rock and roll?
Well, I think we could have made great records. I think we could have made, you know, 10 million selling records. You know, I think that if we had, I had pretty much at my fingertips like really good resources. I mean, I think the main reason why a lot of these people, like Paul and other, you know, like the Elton John people were in the picture was because they were my friends, you know.
Right.
And they really liked, I think, it's not too strong a statement, they liked my energy, they liked what I was going for, and they were eager to be a part of it. And it was only when you added this dead weight of the record label sort of like, you know, wanting to kibitz every step of the way, it got less interesting.
And so how early on, because we want to stay on the dark side just for a few minutes.
Love the dark side.
How early on did you realize Scandal was going to really live up to its name? Because you brought in, you know, as Stephen calls it, the brat, you know, the tough cookie who was gorgeous, who had the voice. But there were things that went along with that.
That's right. Well, you know, Patty's talent is really overwhelming. I mean, as a singer and as someone with a feel for music, with a musical soul, I think that she is unparalleled.
And she was not classically trained in any way, shape, or form.
No, not at all. She, you know, her mother operated nightclubs in the Village, Cafe Wa. She grew up just, you know,
around a lot of music.
And I mean, she is an incredible, to this day, I can't think of anyone that I think is a better singer. I mean, she can sing like, you know, Somewhere Over the Rainbow, and just she'll kill you.
And belt it.
Well, I mean, she can just, covers the full range. I mean, I was so knocked out. And so, you know, I recognized that there were going to be some problems. But
we all choose our partners that way, don't we?
Yeah. Yeah, she was absolutely the best singer choice I felt I could make at that
time. So you were willing to put up with what you knew was to come?
I suppose, yeah. Yeah.
And at that, in terms of the record company, because, you know, you talk about control and power and all that, when the record company realized, and I'll bet they realized this before The Warrior was even, you know, before that album was even recorded, that this was going to be a tricky band.
Oh yeah.
Did they come to you and say, well, you know, Zach, we have to keep Patty happy because she's the singer and
Well, the record company, you know, they're very Machiavellian. They knew that they really needed me to keep Patty in line, to make sure that she showed up for radio promotion dates, to be able to organize tours. I mean, to keep the band moving. But at the same time, they recognized that the chemistry between Patty and I was fraught with problems, and you know, that it was, you know, divisive as well. So everybody was just kind of walking gingerly.
Nobody was stupid. Everybody knew what they were doing. But then, as you know what you're doing, you're still trying to take the twists and turns in a careful sort of way.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't even, okay, now you had a revisionist history. I didn't even realize who her first husband was.
Richard Hell.
I had no idea.
I don't know Richard well. You know, we hung out. I went to the wedding. They had a really fun wedding in the East Village.
Oh, I'll bet.
And I think that, you know, it crystallized her whole experience of growing up in the East Village. It was like that was as
she,
high
she
as
married,
you,
she married. She married East Village the East Village prototype.
Well, yeah, and the prince of the East Village. I mean, musically,
right.
Like that's as high as you could go. You know, at that time, you
right?
Know, and her world was still the East Village.
He was definitely in his moment. He was right up there with you know, television and the Heads and that whole strip there of that particular. And yet, so she was associated with that, but that was not the band she was in.
No.
There was, I mean, Scandal's over here, they're over here.
Mm-hmm.
There was no, I mean, I don't want to say there was no relationship, but that's what's great about rock and roll, of course,
mm-hmm.
is that the two can coexist.
Well, the minute Columbia had their teeth into it at all, it was clear that it was going to be like an unabashedly just pop, like just straight pop, you know, competing with the, you know, Pat Benatar effect.
Right.
You know, at any cost.
Right. So let's play a couple more tracks. What have we got? Speaking of pop, here we go. What are we going to listen to?
The Warrior.
Feeding on your hungry eyes. I bet you're not so serious.
All right, Zach, to this day, and it happens every single time, shooting at the walls of heartache, bang, bang, I am the warrior, now will be in my head for the rest of, I think at least until Monday. So that song, that becomes the iconic, Goodbye to You is an iconic song for this band, mm-hmm. and The Warrior is an iconic song for this band.
Right.
And at that moment in time, as you're playing the riffs on this song and it's happening, you're saying?
Well, I'm saying it's a deal with the devil a little bit, and it is.
99% of the world who's listening to this interview would make the assumption that you wrote that song.
Right. Yeah. No, it's people make that mistake all the time, but it's, and I can take credit for getting it on the record. I mean, it was a song that Nick Gilder had in his pocket.
Nick Gilder's an amazing hot child in the city, all that. That's amazing stuff.
He intended that to be his comeback song. Mike Chapman was doing his record after he finished ours.
Do you think Nick Gilder, I mean, all kidding aside, come on, hot child in the city, and before that, Roxy Roller, mm-hmm. you know, which he didn't even put his name on it.
Yeah.
You know, do you really think that Nick Gilder with that voice?
I knew it would be good for Scandal, and I knew that. That was the second record. Mike Chapman was producing it, and his standards for getting things on that record were either that it be great, that you know he write it, or that you know.
Well, Mike Chapman had that the sweet. I mean, he had that guitar sound.
Yeah, I mean, you can't take it away from him. He had a formula, you know, for doing it. But some people need the engineer to do it every time, and he could go seamlessly through any studio, any engineer, and achieve the result he wanted.
So having to live with that as the iconic song for the band you formed.
Well, it's kind of the, at that point, it was like so much of a cartoon to me. I mean, it was before we even really started doing that record, I realized that the project was like wildly out of control for me anyway. And that, okay, now let's just take it for the commercial ride.
Right. And so take the bucks.
Yeah.
Take the money and run.
Because at that point, you know, you're the lone rebel just going like, no. You know, it's just not a good role to be in at that point when you got a machine that's just ready to rock.
Now, what about Patty in this, you know, punk world of hers? And there she is singing this.
Well, that's the oddity of Patty. You know, she's a person who respects power before, you know, art in a way. And so the fact that, you know, Al Teller from Columbia came to her and said, this is the way we're going to do it. Was enough to simply have her step aside.
And this record is going to make gazillions of dollars.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's hilarious. We sat in a meeting and, you know, this guy just looked us in the eye and he said, you're going to be rich. And I thought that was, I had to stop from laughing, but I mean, it was
a spinal tap moment, isn't it? So yeah. Circling back to Schaefer, that's a spinal tap moment.
Yeah, it was a good one.
Oh, boy. But he wasn't wrong. The record sold how many copies?
Oh, it sold, a million three or something.
And it was a singles world back then. So it went to, the album went to, if I remember my research, went to something like number 17 or 16 or something on Billboard.
Right.
And how far did the single go?
Two.
It went to number two.
Mm-hmm.
And did you say to yourself, see if we did something else, it would have gone to number one?
No, I was really pretty checked out, you know, mentally. I was pretty checked out of the project by then. It wasn't your
band anymore.
It really was not.
It was
my
the record company's band.
Yeah, yeah. It was. It totally was. And I kind of surrendered.
So let's okay. So now let's skip a whole pile of years. So Scandal, you know, everybody can just go back on the web and watch that channel with the V and the H and the one in it to learn all the dirty stuff.
The whole run of Scandal is about 4 years.
Right.
You know, by 1985, beginning of 1985, I was completely...
It was like burnt.
Gone from it. Yeah, yeah. It the record company shifted gears from Scandal
to Patty.
To a Patty Smyth, you know, solo.
Yeah, because her big album was, what, 87?
Yeah, yeah. Al Teller at Columbia was her champion, and he went to MCA and took her along and, you know... was in her corner for a long time.
And so you took a deep breath and?
Well, other opportunities that had come along while I was busy with Scandal were just not things I could really make time for, and they included, you know, like songs for films and advertising.
Right.
And Patty and I had signed into a whole series of contracts for publishing and other things, so that any record we made, all the earnings were attached. It took us a long time to get paid for stuff that we did for Scandal. And I discovered that by doing like a commercial, I'd get paid in 30 days, and it didn't come under any of my contracts. Yeah, back then. And I didn't have to tour, you know, so I could just build a studio in New York and just hang out there and still have time to like do, you know, like record projects with my friends and play on sessions and stuff. And it was great. And I went like hook, line, and sinker into that camp. Well, Bands Reunited came about like 2 years ago.
Two years ago, like that,
you know, right out of the blue.
Right.
They just showed up my doorstep.
You really had no idea. There was no prep on that whatsoever.
No, that's a true ambush. They call and say, hey, we want to have a meeting with you about doing some underscoring for MTV, and you know, we need an hour to talk to you.
And there
then
you
open the door, and there's a 30-man film crew there.
There you go.
Yeah.
Yeah, 30-man film crew for a very casual little...
Yeah.
People don't really know the mechanics. They think, oh, yeah, someone just shows up with a little video camera. No, they show up with makeup and lights.
Well, you got the 30-man film crew, and then the 35 neighbors behind them, and, you know... It was really unbelievable scene. But, you know, we went and did that, you know, and it was painless, even fun, you know, reliving the rock star life. And that led to a VH1 Legends tour following it. And now we're going to do it again.
And now, this summer, live on stage.
Rick Springfield, Loverboy, Eddie Money, Scandal, the 80s. We are the 80s. Well, it's a six CD set plus a DVD box set.
Wow.
And just the Walmart numbers. I mean, it's unbelievable.
So how do you feel about this, going out and doing this again?
You know, it always...
I mean, you and Patty have kind of made up to a certain extent, have you not?
I would say that...
That was my one New Music Express question. We'll pretend that was an NME question.
You know, Patty and I are always going to have, you know, conflicts. It's built into our dynamic. And
right.
We have them, you know, every day.
Right.
And yet, you know, we can turn to one another and just say, you know, I love you and I love what I've done with you. And it's, you know, it's sweet. But it's tough. It's tough. Even something like this that, you know, shouldn't be still has its...
But you're not too old to go out on tour and rock and roll.
No, the band sounds great. So it's never sounded better, actually.
There you go. Well, and on stage, I ask this of all the new bands, especially the ones that are really slick, you know, and I would say that, you know, Scandal was a, you know, at least in that latter year, those stuff that you didn't like, was a slick band.
Oh, yeah.
But on stage, are people surprised when it's a much rockier band?
I would say, you know, our shows went so well, and people, I think, were kind of... I could see they were surprised, whether they expected that we were like older now and not, you know, capable of it, or just never had heard Scandal live. I mean, Scandal was always much more aggressive live than it was on record.
And how many dates do you get to do?
I think we're doing 12 this summer.
Right. And you and I have talked about this off microphone, still searching for a West Coast.
We've been offered a lot of West Coast dates. We were initially offered all the dates on this tour, which would have been 30, and then we were offered a sort of a patchwork that included Washington, Oregon, and California. And everybody is based in New York, and except me,
right?
And so they're loath to take the West Coast dates just because it's more difficult.
It's a lot of work.
You know, I'm going to play you a song that I wrote with Patty that was never released for Scandal. Kind of shows a different side of her. A song I always really liked. It's just a demo. It's track six.
Track six. All right, here we go. Come on.
Girl. And the same song keeps playing and playing. He listens so close and starts saying, she's a reckless girl. She's a reckless girl. She's a heartless girl. When it comes to me, I know that she was beside you, said she would stay, but that was a lie. That story you made, alone at the bar, turning fiction to fact. But she's not coming back. She's a reckless girl. She's a reckless girl. She's a heartless. She's a reckless girl. She's a reckless girl. She's a reckless girl. A heartless girl. She's a
That was a song that, you know, Patty and I just wrote one day and just kind of
It's lovely.
Did in the studio. And
could have been a hit.
I like it. And I love how she sounds on it, you know, and I think it just kind of shows a different side.
I didn't realize until I was listening to that, that, you know, as a singer, she does have that perfect, you know, she can put it out there, but then she's got just enough of the little rasp.
Yeah, I know.
Just that little sexy kind of, you know, that you think she's about to turn hoarse, and she's not hoarse at all.
No, and it's just, it's so natural. It just comes on, like, in the curve. I mean, people that are given an instrument like that, are it's just God-given, because you cannot learn that stuff.
Exactly. So, we have a bunch of other little things to play.
Well, one of the most fun afternoons I ever had was when IBM hired me to record James Brown for an IBM theme song.
That was the IBM Maceo personal computer. Wouldn't that be funny? They name a personal computer Maceo, and James Brown gets to go, Maceo!
They said, we've hired James Brown. He's going to come to the studio. He's going to record your track first, and then we're going to do the music video in the adjoining studio.
Working in America. I heard that, didn't I?
Oh, yeah.
You know, I played Living in America on my show just a few weeks ago.
Really?
Yeah. How funny. Working in America.
With some great players. Yeah, it was fun. But
James, I wonder if James Brown knows how to use Windows. I can't get this to open.
He got to that shoot, and they said, Mr. Brown, we have a stylist for you, Christian, you know, like some, you know, $9,000 a day guy. And he's like, oh, no, I use Clarence. They sent Christian away, and then it was time for the film shoot. They said, okay, Mr. Brown, get going on the Clarence thing. Clarence was gone.
Oh, no.
And it took all the IBM executive limos at all the vintage record stores to find him, And when he finally came back, he had this one big curler in his pocket, and he stuck it under Mr. Brown's hair.
And that was it.
Whoosh. It's like, okay.
That was styling.
That was it.
Why don't you promote the tour? Because we do have listeners outside of the Bay Area.
Nice. Well, the first date that Scandal's doing is August 6th in Dallas, August 10th, Denver. And that's all I know right now.